for on the assumption that we can go on endlessly. So it means, among other things, that our kids are going to have to come up with new kinds of economic systems. Man finds himself turned back upon himself to solve the ensuing problems that come with a limited universe. What is he going to do? Are we going to call world conferences at Geneva or at The Hague to set standards for population, for air and water utilization, for food distribution? Or are we more likely to engage in genocide? And you know where the lines will get drawn. Struggling with one another for the dwindling resources of the earth and for the still fertile places. If past history is any guide, the latter alternative seems much more likely than the former. Let's hope our kids are smarter than we've been. Our children are unaccustomed to times of scarcity. Such times operate with a totally different kind of ethic than times of affluence. Affluence depends upon expanding markets and the regular replacement of manufactured products. Times of scarcity depend upon the husbanding of resources, long-term dependability and maintenance of manufactured products. People of the future may deal much less charitably with their ill and their aged than we do. Medicare may cease in the future. It is certainly within the bounds of conceivability that arbitrary limits may be set to life itself, that no one will be allowed to live beyond age 70 or age 75. The incurables and defectives may be disposed of. We had a taste of these kinds of times in the early years of Nazi Germany, also in Soviet Union. So it could get pretty grim. Imagine living in a time, you know, when you're crowding 65, and imagine living in a country where the law says that you may not live beyond your 70th birthday. You know, and we have certain little quiet places out in the country where you breathe your last when you become 70. What we may look forward to in the years of our children's maturity is a society which will increasingly control the life cycle itself and may arbitrarily set limits to it. Life and the production of life will cease to be a guaranteed human right freely exercised. The alternative to life control will be revolution and radical destruction. So they can very possibly expect to see much more stringent rules about who may marry, who may not marry, more stringent rules about family size. Sterilization may become a rather common phenomenon, and there will be efforts to control population in increasingly visible kinds of ways if we aren't able to do it invisibly. The authors of the articles before this one all commonly agreed that technology was going to be increasingly important as the years go by, even as it has. And none of them expected that by the year 2000 we would have a 1984 type of society where a man was a slave to his technology. I suspect that they're correct, that by the year 2000 we will be much more the masters of our technology than we are today. I think we've had enough technology that we can see a general kind of pattern that as new technology comes into general use, it tends to assume mastery over the lives of people. We've seen this with television. After a time, they begin to understand it and its effect upon themselves, and they then become its masters and control it. And it settles down into its proper servant function. But there are two important topics related to the increased role of technology which none of the people that had done the other articles made any reference to. So I did. Number one, as the business world becomes increasingly technological, less and less human energy is necessary for the production of goods and services which American society desires. This will continue in the future. As a result, Our children can confidently expect not to work as long or as hard as their parents, even as their parents did not work as long and as hard as their parents did before them. At the present time, there is no indication on the economic horizon, and there's no reason why the general pattern of shorter and shorter hours and higher salaries as a result of technological advance should terminate. As a matter of fact, we are beginning very rapidly to move in the direction of a national guaranteed minimum income. I'm sure Vern Rickey is going to talk about that when he gets here at the end of the week, first part of next week. And as this becomes a reality, we can expect to be moving also in the direction of fewer and fewer people laboring and minimum guaranteed annual income increasing. In other words, we will be moving increasingly in the direction of our technology producing for national needs rather than for private, individual, personal needs. And that's the way it seems to be going. Number two, one of the byproducts of the increased role of technology in our lives is the increasing number of services which are brought to the consumer. I think this trend is also going to continue. The service will come to the consumer rather than the consumer to the service. Whereas our children may very well find themselves world travelers, both as businessmen and as vacationers, perhaps also as students, at other times they are likely to be, for the most part, homebodies, isolates from the rest of the society, communicating with it by means of technology, living in their high-rise apartment or wherever they live, in communication by means of television, getting their food brought to them, everything else coming to them, so that they don't have to leave the premises unless they want to. This is going to have a profound effect on the way in which the church is going to have to preach the gospel in the next century, and the way in which our children's children are educated. It is not unlikely that the children of tomorrow may attend school at a corner of their living room, facing a television console equipped with the capacity to relay voice and image back to some teaching center where either a live person responds or a videotape recorder takes a message for future response. And if this happens, very likely the mothers will be returned to the homes to serve as monitors. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised but what the federal government will pay them to perform that function. Now you can imagine the implications of this for community. Maybe a great many people that don't know how to be society because they'll be living in their own little cubicle. Create all kinds of totally different psychological problems than we have today. Cultural changes have this paradoxical characteristic that at any given time we can see opposed trends going on at the same time. Trends which are categorically opposed to one another going on at the same time. Union movements between churches tend to be accompanied by the splitting off of small factions of those who don't want to go along, with the result that oftentimes after the union movement ceases, there are a larger number of independent church bodies than existed before the union activity began. Now, usually, where as a result of the union, you got a bigger unit, but and you got a lot of little fragments that have split off from it. Peace pickets militantly battle the police as they protest against war. The same kind of paradoxical character can be seen in some of the characteristics of the culture that lies ahead of us. Number one, as leisure time increases, people will find themselves busier than ever. I suspect that our children will feel even busier than we are, and they will probably have even more psychological hang-ups than we have. I almost desperately wish that our kids could live at a slower pace than we live, but I don't see it happening. Number two, as society becomes increasingly technological, I suspect that its cultural content will become increasingly humanistic. In other words, that the humanities will play a more important role in our kids' life than they are playing right now. As technology plays an increasingly overall role in our lives, and as we become increasingly concerned about the viability and the adequacy of many of our values, we will find increasingly that the humanities, including religion, will be our sole resources to enable us to weigh and to create significant value. Something a little side comment here. It started moving in its own particular direction. I was sitting back in the corner, and I was smiling to myself because I'm staff here in what my field is philosophy. And I heard an awful lot of people doing philosophy this morning, only they didn't know they were doing it. Because when you get down to the real gut problems and the ultimate issues and things are falling apart, you turn to philosophy whether you realize it or not. And you become a philosopher and you wrestle with your problems and you work them out. And there was a real great philosophy session going, which started out as a kind of a sociology and religious orientation, and it got into philosophy. Well, I think this is what is going to happen. Because as the world from what it is now, our kids are going to have to get philosophical, and they are going to have to go to the creative arts to come up with the ideas. Because the ideas always come out of the creative arts. Because you have to create ideas. And so they arise out of the creative arts, and so our children, I think, are going to be more humanities-oriented than they have been over the last 10 or 15 years. Okay, I'm sure that this is going to be a welcome trend for those whose love is history, philosophy, theology, and the arts, areas at universities which have been in the doldrums for a number of years. Having been pushed from center stage first by the physical sciences, then the life sciences, and most recently by the social sciences. Humanities have always flourished in a time of affluence and of concern about the cultural values of the time. The golden age of the humanities always came during and after revolutionary periods. This being the case, I would be most surprised also if 30 years from now we do not find an increasing amount of African and Asian cultural materials receiving world attention as the so-called developing nations of the world are increasingly productive in the arts and are able to communicate them to other parts of the world. Another characteristic that is already discernible, which several of the prior authors made reference to, is a trend which is beginning to emerge to solve our human problems physically rather than psychologically, particularly using chemistry therapeutically and preventively to solve psychological and educational problems. This is just beginning to come. We had the first indication of this when tranquilizers were invented. But there are all kinds of things going on right now, and largely in the experimental stage, to modify personality, solve personality problems, increase memory capacity, memorization speed, reading speed, all sorts of things. To the extent that these kinds of approaches are successful, the psychological and sociological disciplines are going to become less important and will yield to other disciplines. The psychiatric couch became much less significant when the tranquilizer was discovered. As we find more and more chemical ways of interrupting, reducing, or eliminating human problems, there will be less and less need for clinical assistance. Someday we will reach a point in educational practice where instead of a physical examination before entering school, a child will have a chemical examination and his curriculum will be prescribed in terms of certain pills to be taken as well as certain materials to be studied. And we're just beginning to approach that. The education of people inevitably will be more organized and simplified. Much more material will be programmed. Increasingly, we will find the sciences moving closer to one another instead of splitting off from one another. We already have biochemistry. Shortly, we are going to have psychochemistry or chemical psychology, whichever one of the disciplines wins the battle for top billing. Movement from one discipline to another is becoming increasingly easy. As more research is done on how we learn, we are becoming more competent at teaching. And finally, since costs are rising dramatically in education, we are going to find concerted efforts by the government and private industry to simplify the educative process, to shorten its duration, to reduce as much as possible of it to technology, and if possible, to prepackage and mass produce as much of it as possible. I'm not saying that's good or bad. The notion of technology and local services are two very important ideas. Future ages may very well look back upon our age as the one which discovered the capacity to perform action at a distance. Ever since Aristotle, we have believed that action has to be proximate. This is this, and that's how action happens. But you always hit the one right next to you if you're an alley. We have developed the capacity to cause things to happen remotely from us without intervening connection, physical connection. Most beautiful example of this is the moon landing. Because of our increased capacity to perform action at a distance by means of electronic devices, there's reason to doubt whether there will continue to be an increasing emphasis on community and concentration of population. The reasons for cities to exist will begin to disappear. It may well be that we will solve our problems of pollution and of the threat of atomic destruction by decentralization. Give you a little example of what can relatively easily happen to make atomic destruction, more said laughable, I don't like to say laughable, but at least much less ominous. Suppose that we would decentralize the United States and we would locate all of our communities underground. What happens to atomic warfare? We've got to invent new ways of killing one another.
Yeah.
You see, here is a relatively easy solution to that problem. It now creates new kinds of problems. Create new kinds of technology. But all of a sudden it makes atomic warfare virtually meaningless. See, unless, you know, we play a little game. Can I knock out more of your rockets than you can knock out of mine? This might be a nice way to keep the military occupied. You know, all the rest of us are underground, and we have our own air systems, air support, you know, life support systems, and they can play around with the rockets as much as they want until they're all used up. Right, that's right. Okay. I have a couple more ideas here, and you're ready to go, so I'll try to get done as fast as I can, so I can let you loose. People get together in order to enjoy an increased number of services which have traditionally been available only where concentrations of population are to be found. This is primary justification for the city. As we become increasingly adept at transporting these services inexpensively, it will become less and less necessary for people to cluster together. One need only point to people who have come out to Holden here by car from Chicago or New York or any one of the eastern big cities, you know, where we live on our own commercial television station, go to some little two-bit town in Wyoming, and turn the TV set on and have six channels coming in by cable television. See what I mean? Consequently, it may well be that in the future that people will need to see one another only for social reasons. Federal government is already thinking about creating pilot cities of 40,000 to 100,000 population in areas of the country which right now have very limited population. It may well be that by the turn of the millennium, by the beginning of the 2000s, instead of the megalopolis which spreads its density across the land, which many people had predicted, the geography of the future may exhibit a peppering of small cities across the landscape. The optimum communities for living over the last several centuries has been between 30,000 and 80,000. Such a city was small enough for people to feel at home in all parts of it, where they felt they knew one another. It was large enough to provide the urban services one might want, not congested enough to create blight at a rate faster than it can be corrected. And we may very well find this kind of a community becoming more and more the pattern that Americans will prefer in the future. The city of today is struggling in its own waste with the tentacles of its transportation system wrapped around its neck. If cities are to survive, they will have to become increasingly oriented to metropolitan or regional ownership of basic services, including heating, air conditioning, and in particular, transportation. I suspect also that we are going to have to invent a better economic device than the strike. And I've got anything to suggest as an alternative to it, but I think the strike is becoming increasingly stupid. And I think that more and more, as we see things happening in a city like New York City and so on, I think that more and more the nation is going to react against the strike for ethical and moral reasons. And I don't know what can come along to replace it, and I suspect our kids will think of something better than the strike as a way of solving problems. The supply of teachers is beginning to outnumber the demand. I suspect that in the future, communities will have fewer and fewer teachers. Individualized teaching on a face-to-face basis will occur only with problem students. As long as a child can get along without face-to-face confrontation, he won't have a real life to confront him, which means that mama and papa's role is going to be more and more important to develop the human element in the child's life, and maybe that's where it should have been all along. Red China in the political world is the big question mark of the future. Because of its location and its population and its vitality, our children are going to have to reckon with it. Finally, what's going to happen to Christianity by the year 2000? I think that there may be some small-type wars fought for religious or ideological reasons. The Christian church may very well find itself literally involved in a death struggle with Islam. For many years, Americans have feared the threat of international communism, but I think they have much greater reason to be concerned about the threat of Mohammedanism and perhaps a relatively new Japanese religion that seems to be coming along by leaps and bounds called Sakagaki. Don't ask me what it's about, because I know very little about it, except that it is coming on fantastically rapidly in Japan and is beginning to get exported. New religions have incredible vitality and are very difficult to overcome. After more than 1,000 years, the Christian church has yet to discover a way successfully to deal with or to overcome Mohammedanism. It was able to win back only southern France and Spain from Mohammedanism. Unless Christianity wakes up to its real competition and takes intelligent steps to outflank or outstrip it, it will fade to the status of a second-class religion in the world. In virtually all of the emerging nations, Christianity is identified with the white man or with Western European or American culture. Foreign clergymen are not particularly welcome. The gospel has to be brought by the laity to those nations. In Africa and in Asia, the religion of Islam is consciously identifying itself with people of brown and yellow skin, and they are intermixing religious and racial values. This is certainly going to have repercussions in the United States among minority peoples, matter of fact, we already is. The honeymoon is over for the Christian church and for the white man, and they might as well recognize it. The church is going to have to rid itself of cultural identification, and the white man of parochialism, if life is not going to grow more difficult in the next generation for both of them. So, the world of our children appears to be one where the crucial problems will involve the ultimate questions of life. Our children will have a great deal of free time to think about those questions. We will have fed them well and taught them well. The solutions to their environmental problems will lie ready at hand. There can be peace. God certainly is going to have a great deal to say to their generation. Whether or not they will hear what he has to say will well determine whether their children's children are even going to have a world. There are two contrary strains which may shape our children's future. The one leads in the direction of Armageddon and has led us thus far to the point of the possibility of atomic warfare. But there are much worse horrors than that possible. The other direction leads toward human reconciliation and understanding. Thus far, we have made very little progress down that path. If, in his inscrutable wisdom, God has chosen that this small planet shall be man's sole temporal habitation, we are going to have to find new ways to love one another, and lacking that, to tolerate one another for all of our children's sake, because time is fast running out. Now, say what you want.
I would like to ask you a question when you used to speak to your lady when you were talking about morality. How do you define Christianity then?
I'm talking about organized Christian denomination.
This is the political position of the church in relationship to the state and the
rest of the in relationship to people, culture.
Yeah, and then I would say think of ourselves as a Christian.
No, I'm more specifically than that. I mean, organized groups who identify themselves as Christian and feel an evangelical compulsion. Yeah. Will?
Two books that I'm more familiar with. Predicting is Elvin Toffler's Future Shock and Herman Kahn's The Year 2000. However, I've got some arguments about predicting what's going to happen in the future. I've also got rather serious arguments about what we're going to leave for our children to take care of.
Okay.
To make it very brief, I feel that, if I get the gist of what you're saying, you may be offering more of a challenge to start your motion and do some stuff now, and less of creating problems for our children. And I think that, you know, they're going to have some unique ones of their own also. That's the first point I want to make. Now, the other point I wanted to make, though...
Can I just go one other mark in here, Will? Yeah, I think the problem of the prophet, and I like things to try to get people to think about things, the problem is of the prophet is that as soon as you have prophesied something is going to happen, you have now made it possible for people to take steps to prevent it from happening.
Yeah.
So, you know, any intelligent person that writes a prophetic article writes it to wake people up to things that can happen so that they see to it that it doesn't happen.
Right. Now, I agree with that. So I have no problem with that. You're not really talking about the future. You're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Thank
you. The second part of my statement has to do with now. Your last two paragraphs have already happened. Statisticians and data-keeping people I pointed out that Christianity on the African and Asian continents within the next decade.
I nowhere suggest or want to suggest, you know, that we millet, that we organize armies for the faith. But what I'm saying is that one of the characteristics of Christians over the last 20 to 25 years is that they have become increasingly pacifistic and identified pacifism with Christianity, with the highest form of Christianity. And what I'm saying is that within the next 30 years, we may very well find ourselves literally, physically under attack by Islam. What do? You make the sign of the cross and they go away? See, what I'm saying is that we may very well find ourselves second rate, despised, physically under attack. And we better be prepared for it.
Well, in what sense do you need to get ready to be these things or ready to fight and become?
Well, I suppose you can take two attitudes. One attitude you can take is say, well, if this is what God wants, then we will, and He will provide a way. I suppose another attitude you can take is, we don't particularly care to have this be the case, and so we'll have to take whatever steps are we can figure out with what we believe to secure that it doesn't. But one of my primary concern here is to say that volcano, and all of a sudden you get a flurry of activity and